The following program, The Russ Belville Show, is intended for responsible adults only. We advocate to the repeal of marijuana prohibition for adults. We discuss the science, culture, and controversy about America's marijuana laws. We do not advocate any illegal activity and encourage all listeners to learn their state and federal marijuana laws. Opinions and claims made by guests and advertisers on The Russ Belville Show are their own, and The Russ Belville Show cannot be held legally responsible for their validity or reliability. Viewer discretion is advised.
You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
From the promise of legalization. Of prohibition.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
The Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
I hear you had a question for me.
Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belville.
We love it. Tokers and tokens, welcome. It is Wednesday, April 10th, 2013, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. So glad you could make it to the show today. All sorts of great news and information for the cannabis community that we need to relate to you over the next 2 hours. Coming up at the end of the show, I've got time for a radical rant. I've been looking at this case of Joshua and Sharon Hacken. We've told you the story about this supposedly anti-government couple that kidnapped their own kids and fled to Cuba just so they could have their kids, all came down off of a pot bust in Louisiana. We're going to get down and dirty into this story and take a look at it and analyze it from the perspective of what exactly is child endangerment in this country anyway. Also on today's show at half past, you know what we do on Wednesdays, it's Dr. Mitch Earlywine joining us. He's the author of the Ask Dr. Mitch column in High Times magazine, as well as the author of lots of books having to do with marijuana and its users. If you've got a question on cannabis science, culture, history, or health, you'll want to call in today at 971-533-7111, or you can join us in the chat room and ask your questions via chat, and we'll get them live on the air for one of America's most prominent researchers in the field of marijuana, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Also on today's show at 20 after, it's time for our daily Toker Tunes, and today is Ivory Wednesday. We'll be turning things over to Brian the Red, who'll have something wonderful for us for Ivory Wednesday, I'm sure, which also reminds me, tonight at 8 o'clock Pacific Time, Red Eyes Reggae Flashback. You get a full hour of true roots reggae rhythms. If you're into the reggae, you want to stay tuned tonight at 8 o'clock live. Then, let's see, we've also got on today's show, time to go behind the headlines. President Obama has released the fiscal year 2014 budget, and that includes the budget for the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Kevin Sabet is all agog about the new numbers coming out, because supposedly now we're all about treatment and prevention, and there is no war on drugs. Did you know that, by the way? We don't have a war on drugs anymore. I didn't know if you noticed. We'll talk about those numbers. We'll get behind the headlines, and I'll show you why they aren't all that Kevin Sabet thinks they're cracked up to be. But before we get to all of that, we've got to get to our 420 radio news and lots of news stories for today, including a look at the state of Montana, which has enacted a per se DUID. Massachusetts Attorney General has overturned bans on dispensaries. Maine is voting for hemp even without DEA permission. Oregon is looking at PTSD for people, or medical marijuana for people with PTSD. And our billboard here in Portland that got torn down, it's back up. We'll tell you all about it after this.
The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com.
What's happening, funky brothers and soul sisters? This is Big Daddy, and I want you to win a t-shirt courtesy of the Funky Roller Rink at 420radio.org. Just tune into the Funky Roller Rink this week and keep track of all the hip-hop tunes and sample my Funk 3, baby.
Music make you move, 'cause you can dig the groove.
Then, the following week, at the start of the show, just tweet at Funky Roller Rink the results of the hip-hop set list in the order they were played. The first three skaters with the correct set list win some free threads, baby. But you gotta watch the show to win. It's the Sample My Funk t-shirt contest this week on the Funky Roller Rink. Check out the Funky Roller Rink blog on 420radio.org for more info. And as always, keep it funky, keep it funky, keep it funky.
I'm Sub Cool from Team Green Avenger. At TGAGenetics.com, we are working on the leading edge of medical strains. Our strains are rigorously tested for THC, CBD, THCV, and other critical cannabinoids. Know your grow. Check out our genetic diversity at TGAGenetics.com, the home of Jelly Bean, Jack the Ripper, Vortex, and other award-winning cannabis strains.
Time for your 420 Radio News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. I'm Russ Belville. Montana enacts new per se law for THC in blood. Authorized patients face registration revocation if convicted. This from normal.org. Montana lawmakers recently gave final approval to House Bill 168, an act revising laws relating to driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs to provide a legal limit for the amount of Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. House lawmakers approved the measure by a vote of 80 to 18, and Senate lawmakers concurred by a vote of 48 to 12. The governor signed the legislation into law April 5th. House Bill 168 imposes a 5 nanogram per milliliter per se threshold for THC in blood for anyone operating a motor vehicle. Montana is the fifth state to impose a per se threshold for cannabinoids, joining Pennsylvania at 1 nanogram, Ohio at 2 nanograms, Nevada at 2 nanograms, and Washington State at 5 nanograms per milliliter. 10 additional states impose zero tolerance thresholds for the presence of cannabinoids and or their metabolites. First-time convictions under the new Montana state law are punishable by license revocation, loss of commercial driver's license, a fine of up to $1,000, and up to 6 months imprisonment. State-licensed medical marijuana patients convicted under the per se law also face revocation of their state registry identification card. Massachusetts Attorney General strikes down local bans on medical marijuana dispensaries from Boston.com. Massachusetts cities and towns may not ban medical marijuana dispensaries, according to a ruling issued Wednesday by the state attorney general's office, but they will be allowed to adopt temporary moratoriums, gaining time to craft local rules for regulating the facilities. The attorney general's office said outright local bans would frustrate the purpose of the medical marijuana law, overwhelmingly passed by referendum last fall, which allows patients with certain medical conditions to obtain marijuana for medical use. A handful of municipalities, including Wakefield, Melrose, and Reading, had adopted bans, citing concerns about substance abuse, crime, and property values. Maine Legislative Committee overwhelmingly approves measure allowing hemp cultivation. This from theweedblog.com. Yesterday, with a vote of 9-1, Maine's Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry Committee approved a measure explicitly allowing hemp cultivation in the state, even before a federal change takes place. Under current Maine law, hemp is legal for certain purposes, though the law mandates that an individual can't receive a license to grow until federal law changes. This measure would remove that requirement and would allow farmers in the state to begin cultivating hemp this year. On top of making this change, the measure would remove a requirement that mandates that applicants for a hemp license submit fingerprints to the state, which would be taken by law enforcement. The measure now moves toward a full House vote. A companion bill is currently being considered in the Maine Senate. Bill allowing medical marijuana for post-traumatic stress disorder advances to Oregon Senate floor. This from the statesmanjournal.com. A bill that would allow people with post-traumatic stress disorder to get medical marijuana is now headed to the Senate floor without any changes. The Senate Judiciary Committee moved Senate Bill 281 to the Senate floor this morning on a 3-2 vote. There were a number of amendments to the bill, including one that would require medical marijuana users to renew their registry identification card after 60 days instead of annually. Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee Floyd Prozanski, Democrat of Eugene, said that he decided to leave the bill unchanged because he thought the amendments were, quote, not necessary or appropriate and could do more harm than good, end quote. Portland Marijuana Billboard has new message from KGW.com. The people behind a controversial marijuana billboard in downtown Portland have come up with a new message. The original billboard featured a photo of a glass of beer, a glass of wine, and a marijuana leaf. And below each photo, the words read, beer, wine, and safer, respectively. It was located at Southwest 13th Avenue and Southwest Alder Street. The billboard went up Thursday, March 29th, and by that night, it was no longer standing up. Now a new billboard has gone up that reads, "The truth cannot be destroyed." The Marijuana Policy Project wants to get a measure on the 2016 ballot legalizing recreational marijuana in Oregon. Both Colorado and Washington passed similar bills last year. And two people unconscious after explosion and marijuana found inside a home in South Sacramento. Neighbors heard two cars speeding away from the blaze, and later, two people admitted to the hospital for severe burns. And that's your 420 Radio News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. I'm Russ Belville. When we come back, we go behind the headlines and take a look at the fiscal year 2014 Office of National Drug Control Policy budget and how it's not that different from budgets submitted by George W. Bush. You're listening to The Russ Belville Show on 420radio.org. We'll be right back after these messages. .org is listener-supported cannabis community radio, and while we value every $4.20 donation that comes in monthly from our members, we take this moment to offer an extra special thanks to our most generous donors, who have provided over $1,000 worth of support to 420radio.org. For their privacy's sake, we'll identify these knights and dames of the smoky table as Sir Randy of the Lakes, Dame Kathleen the Beneficent, Dame Kaylee the Wise, Sir Travis of Stumptown, Sir Rolla J of Cush, and others who wish to remain anonymous. Thank you, lords and ladies, for your most generous patronage.
Jive, Mary, Grifo, Grass, Hay. Technically, it's cannabis sativa, the common name, marijuana. She has found a crutch to see her through her difficulties instead of facing up to them and coping with them. And in time, she may be ready to try something different, something better.
Gateway theory doesn't work. It's a reality.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Time for us to go behind the headlines. We're taking a look today at President Obama's fiscal year 2014 drug war budget. I was hip to this by the Twitter today. I noticed something that Kevin Sabet had to say, something about, oh, my gosh, there's so much more money for treatment now. It's a 21st century approach. We're moving forward. More money for treatment. This is the new way, the new kinder, gentler drug war. No more lock 'em up mentality. The drug war is over. Kinder, gentler treatment. Yay! So, being that it was coming from Kevin Sabet, I knew it was completely full of shit and decided to look it up for myself. So I looked up the WhiteHouse.gov press release on this, and here's how they're trumpeting this. They're saying, most notably, the president's budget includes a request for an increase of $1.5 billion over the fiscal year 2012 level to fund drug treatment and prevention services in America, a 16% increase over fiscal year 2012. As a result, the president's budget requests more for treatment and prevention, $10.7 billion, than for federally funded domestic drug law enforcement and incarceration, $9.6 billion. This is what a 21st century approach to drug policy looks like. So the idea here is to say, hey, we're not all about lock them up anymore. Look, we're putting $10 billion into treatment and prevention versus $9.6 billion into federal incarceration. So, see, more money for treatment than for incarceration. The problem is they leave out a couple of other pieces to that puzzle. For the longest time, in fact, going all the way back to the 1990s, the Office of National Drug Control Policy has listed its budgets and compared what they call supply-side reductions versus demand-side reductions. Supply-side reductions would be interdiction, trying to go to, trying to seize drugs, trying to capture weed and coke and heroin. How much of that can we seize? And there's also international aid, the amount of money that we pay to foreign countries to do the same thing. We give international aid to Mexico, to Colombia, to all these countries to lock up their people for the use of drugs. So going to the ONDCP's own sheet on this, the federal drug control spending by function, this is table one in the FY 2014 budget, they show that in 2012, we had a budget that was 62.5% dedicated to supply reduction. Supply reduction would be domestic law enforcement, interdiction, and the international aid. By comparison, the fiscal year 2014 is now 58% supply reduction. So we went from spending $15.3 billion on cops and jails and trying to uproot plants in the forest. We used to spend $15.3 billion on that. Now we're going to spend $14.7 billion on that. We're going to reduce that by $600 million. Now, that's a lot of money, I know, but in percentage comparison terms, we've just reduced it by 4.5%. Now, that's a good thing. We are shifting more of our budgets toward demand reduction. 42% of the budget is for demand reduction, $10.6 billion. Demand reduction is what they call treatment and prevention. Now, I'll go into that in just a second. But for comparison's sake, I thought it would be interesting to see how much of a difference in drug war budgets we have from President Obama versus President Bush. And while Kevin Sebed is all excited about reducing the drug war side of the budget to 58% compared to the drug treatment side of the budget, at 58%, it is just 0.1% difference from George W. Bush's fiscal year 2004 drug war budget, which was 57.9% dedicated to the war side. And consider that George W. Bush, by the end of his first term, had brought that ratio down to 57.9% for the war side from President Clinton's all-time high of 70.7% of the drug war budget being dedicated to law enforcement, interdiction, and international aid. That's right. Bill Clinton's 2000 budget was 70% drug war. So, gosh, congratulations, Obama, for getting the drug war budget back down to where it was in George W. Bush's time. Yay. Great work. Now, let's take a look at what they are calling treatment and prevention here. In the WhiteHouse.gov press release, they point out that they are using this, it's $30 million that they're going to be giving to what they call SBIRT, short, brief interdiction and something, something. Basically, what SBIRT is a program where if you've been sentenced by a drug court and you fail a drug test, you are immediately put into jail for a day. That's right. Jail for relapse. $30 million for the jail for relapse program. Yeah, that's great. Another thing that they've added, $85 million for the drug court system. You know, the drug court system that forces you to pee in a cup and forces you to choose rehab over jail. And if you mess up in rehab, you still go to jail. So yeah, I can see why Kevin Sabet's really excited about this, given that all his friends work in the rehab industry, and this just means more federal dollars coming their way. In fact, $1.4 billion of this drug war budget is dedicated to these kind of rehab and community rehab services. All they are doing in this kinder, gentler drug war is shifting the flow of young, mostly black and brown men from prison industries into drug testing and rehab industries. And none of us are fooled by this, Kevin. You can shift the numbers all you like, but it always comes down to this. Either we punish people for smoking pot, or we accept that people smoke pot. Speaking of people smoking pot,
I accept it.
Do you accept it? Do we all accept it?
I think we can accept
it. We're all in favor. Everybody in the chat room? All good? Sweet. Enjoy yourself. We'll be right back.
Oh, have you ever met that funny reefer man? Reefer man. Have you ever met that funny reefer man? Reefer man. If he said he swam to China, he would sell you South Carolina. Then you know you're talking to that reefer man.
Since medical marijuana became legal in Colorado, Marisol Therapeutics has been one of the most successful dispensaries in the state. Caring for thousands of patients, Marisol produces terrific medicine in their greenhouses and in their outdoor gardens. Here's Michael Stettler, the director of Marisol Therapeutics.
This is our grow. We handle probably over 1,500 patients. We're licensed by the state of Colorado, and we try to do things the proper way. Different patients need different strains for different ailments. It's really hard for us to grow this medicine and have the federal government say this and people out there in the everyday life not understand what this medicine's about.
God wouldn't give us an herb like this for it to be the devil's plant, what they say, and that's wrong.
This is an angel's plant. This is does good for human beings. It's never killed nobody in its entire existence. It's time that we quit witch hunting this plant, and you know we take it into our knowledge and do good like the fathers did, bless this plant, and let that plant teach us.
What's happening, cool cats? This is Big Daddy, and I want you to cruise on over to the Funky Roller Rink. We'll be grooving all night long.
I like it.
Doors open at 11 Eastern, 8 Pacific, every Thursday night.
Funky, delicious.
Everyone knows music and marijuana go together, so let's wind up our 20 after break with the Russ Belville Show's Daily Toker Tunes, the best in pod-safe 420 music from around the web. Today is Irie Wednesday, featuring reggae, ska, and other world music genres. You can get downloads and more information about all our Daily Toker Tunes by visiting music.radicalrust.com. Now, sit back and enjoy your Daily Toker Tune.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Here on 420radio.org, every weeknight at 8 p.m. Pacific, we have a new live show, and four out of five of them are dedicated to music, including tonight's live show, Wednesday nights, 8 p.m., Red Eyes Reggae Flashback, with the best in roots, reggae rhythms, some rare, unreleased, out-of-print tracks, great stuff. And for that, we turn things over today to the host of Red Eyes Reggae Flashback, Brian the Red, a.k.a. Red Eyes. How you doing?
Hey, hi. I'm doing all right. So, you know, the Red Eyes Reggae Flashback, each following Wednesday, I play the title track from the previous week's show. Last week was Is This Justice? So this is Inca Inca doing a track, Is This Justice? So check the lyrics. We'll be right back.
My girlfriend thinks that I smoke too much pot, which is crazy because I think, on the other hand, that I don't smoke enough pot, because if I did, I would be finished, and I'm not. Look. We all have our vices in life, you know? I like to smoke a little weed. She likes to feed the baby. Different strokes for different folks, I say, huh? I'm like, look, get off my back. Isn't that your baby crying? Sorry, our baby. Blow a little weed on it, it'll sleep. Don't hiss, I'm just kidding. Like, I really have a girlfriend. just a baby. It's weird.
I'm a doctor.
I'm a lawyer.
I'm a journalist.
I'm a student.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a representative.
I have cancer.
The outdated laws of prohibition are more dangerous than the plant itself.
I lost my scholarship.
I was fired.
20 million arrests since 1965. This is getting ridiculous.
Our prisons are overcrowded with nonviolent offenders.
We have the opportunity to change.
This is costing our country billions of dollars.
Making my family and I fight in a courtroom is difficult enough when I'm already fighting through chemotherapy.
There's no reason to be scared by tradition anymore.
We can stop this.
We can stop this.
We are the American people.
We can stop this.
And you have our support.
We are old.
Young.
Straight.
Gay.
We're every race and nationality.
And we're not going to give up.
You can tax it.
You can regulate it.
Apply age restrictions.
You can create millions of new jobs.
We can save our economy.
President Obama?
It's time for legalization.
Legalization?
Yes.
We
can.
It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
All right, folks, time to take your medicine. It's Cannabis Science Wednesdays. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us from Albany. How you doing, Dr. Mitch?
Crazy day, but good to be on the show.
Crazy day? What's been so crazy?
Oh, I'm working on a grant for sexual assault stuff, so my head's in a really gruesome literature. So.
Oh, yeah. That's a difficult subject for sure. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that you can get your live questions in here for Dr. Mitch Earlywine. You can dial us at 971-533-7111, or you can get into our chat room on Ustream. Just type /login, and you can create an account. We're looking for the questions out there in the chat. While those are building up, we always give Dr. Mitch the first word here to let us know what's the latest in cannabis science. So what's up, Dr. Mitch?
Well, so a big study out of Harvard's epidemiology department is taking a look at folks who've already had one heart attack. If they smoke cannabis, are they more likely to have another one or die from it? And it's curious because we do get a lot of calls about this. Cannabis does increase your heart rate, but we really only have a few case studies that suggest that it might be related to heart attack at all. And given how common heart attack is and how common cannabis use is, we'd expect a few simply by chance. Yeah. Well, these guys took a good look at some really huge samples, over 1,000 in two different cohorts, and did not find any links between using cannabis and dying from a second heart attack if you've already had a first one. I should mention that the sample sizes of folks who actually smoked a lot of pot and had already had a heart attack were remarkably small. But nevertheless, it doesn't look like there's any evidence that this is as big an issue as some of the case studies have implied.
Hmm. All right. So we'll keep our eye on that. And again, this is where it's going to start getting interesting, folks, over these next 3 or 4 years. As marijuana becomes more legal, there'll be more studies on it, and we'll be able to answer some of these questions. I had a question, and it's interesting you brought up that you were studying sexual assault, because that's what my question had to do with. We just saw the horrific case that went down in Steubenville, Ohio, where high school students were convicted of sexual assault or rape. I forget what the exact charge was. At a party. They were drunk. A girl was way drunk, passed out, and they had, you know, they basically raped her. And we hear stories like this all the time, and almost always they seem to be connected with teenage alcohol use. And I'm just wondering, have we ever heard of that with marijuana use? Is there any evidence of that whatsoever? And isn't it a shame that we're steering kids toward alcohol?
It's curious because, of course, the fact that alcohol is so available and in some way so overlooked on this is really sad. And this is such a horrendously horrible crime. I mean, just despicable behavior in so many ways. The only link we've seen with marijuana use and anything really sexually odd has been links with unsafe sex. And it turned out it wasn't that folks were getting high and then being unwilling to put on a condom. It was just that a lot of disinhibited, extroverted, sensation-seeking folks seem to be using cannabis on some events and failing to use a condom on others. So it didn't seem to be a causal link so much as a kind of disinhibited personality explanation for that. I'll take a closer look at that literature just to be sure, but no, we haven't seen that. But I do also want to emphasize that cannabis does not basically decrease the attentional capacity or increase those aggressive tendencies that we see in the lab with alcohol. So part of the issue seems to be alcohol basically decreases the attention that you have, and so you can't pay attention to certain cues that are essentially saying, I'm not interested in you sexually. But with this example, with somebody passed out, it's just so disgusting and so far from anything even humanly possible that I'm you know, not even going to bring up that as a model.
Yeah. All right. We have a question from our chat room. Normal Patriot would like to know. He says he's learned the hard way that my kidneys won't accept NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, you know, your Tylenols and those kind of things. It causes the renal colic from my kidney stones to spike. I also can't tolerate acetaminophen or codeine or morphine very well. So besides marijuana, I have very little to turn to in terms of pain relief. Can you recommend anything I can ask the doc for to help with the extra pain I'll be dealing with from a kidney stone that's coming through?
As it turns out, it's not something you ask the doctor for, but it's the behavioral interventions that are associated with pain. If you want to email me, I'm happy to send you a link to one of the big treatment manuals on this. It's not the most interesting stuff in the world, but it really is about stress reduction, improving your sleep, making sure you get regular exercise, and all those healthy behaviors your mom's probably been telling you your whole life. But these actually do decrease reports of pain in the headache literature, in the acute pain from injury literature, and I'm sure it would generalize to folks with kidney problems.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel for you, Patriot. I had a kidney stone a couple years back, and it's a unique kind of pain. It's amazing. They say it's worse than childbirth. I can't comment on that, but boy, it was something else. All right, let's go to Lively. Libra's got a question. My psychiatrist mentioned a study where cannabis users suffer memory loss and concentration problems. Can't remember what medical acronym it was, but do you know of it? The study, I suppose.
It's curious because a lot of psychiatrists seem to be fed this at some kind of lecture in their training. Acute use of cannabis, that means while you are high, yes, you do see impairments in forming new memories and the ability to concentrate on difficult topics. But chronic effects, if you've been using for a long time but you're not high at the time of testing, either there is no memory effect or it is so small that it is laughably insignificant. So unfortunately, I'm afraid her psychiatrist has been essentially misinformed.
Yeah, this seems to happen quite a bit. We get doctors that will get this early training and they never react to any of the changes in the literature or the understanding of cannabinoids. Is there any move in the medical profession to, I know you guys have things like continuing education credits you have to get. Is there any move to try to get more understanding of cannabinoids involved in that continuing education?
In fact, just as I was leaving USC, we had it set up so a continuing medical education on cannabinoids was getting started in 2005, and that has really run with it. It's just done really well. There's some efforts to make that happen in Massachusetts, but, I mean, I don't mean to belittle this because psychiatrists are busy. There are new drugs coming out all the time. The DSM is about to change. I mean, all kinds of things are happening for them. Nevertheless, I do feel like in order to be a modern person in practice, either refer somebody to somebody who actually knows this or shut your mouth. Say, I don't know, because clearly this is a real disservice to the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be fascinating over the next 20 years, a generation from now, what the doctors will know and be taught about cannabis will just be completely different than what they've been taught up to now. We're speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, a clinical researcher at SUNY Albany and the author of Understanding Marijuana, Parent's Guide to Marijuana, and the Ask Dr. Mitch column in High Times Magazine. If you are shy about getting your question here live on the air, you can always send it in by email. Sometimes that's easier. Just go to our contact page at 420radio.org. Use a little drop-down box. There's an Ask Dr. Mitch line there, and the email will go straight to Dr. Mitch. Or you can send it to 420research@gmail.com. We have a question here from Cannabosum who wants to know, what can you tell me regarding HIV and cannabis, especially using the Rick Simpson oil?
So unfortunately, there are no data on the Rick Simpson oil. We don't have a cure for HIV. There was a lot of concern that somehow cannabis was going to decrease immune function in people who had HIV or AIDS. It turns out that that was an overgeneralization from work in the Petri dishes. So, yeah, if you do have a bunch of white blood cells in a Petri dish and give them a pound of THC, they do seem to show some modest impairments. But in humans, normal doses of cannabis with reasonable amounts of THC did not seem to impair immune function in HIV patients, so that doesn't seem to be a big issue. I wish we had more data on the Rick Simpson oil. It seems like it's basically a concentrated form of all the cannabinoids. I doubt it would cure any kind of immune dysfunctions, but it seems like it would be good for all the associated neuropathic pain or other symptoms that are often co-varying with HIV, and in the late stages, some of the problems with appetite also ought to be easier to challenge with cannabis involved.
I know that a lot of the history of medical marijuana goes back to the early AIDS activists in the Bay Area, so I imagine there's a lot of anecdotal evidence on this.
It's curious because the huge number of folks who've said they've had a positive response both for pain, for appetite and weight loss, and some things that you wouldn't normally think of, but just basically being able to have a happier, undepressed kind of outlook seems to be pretty compelling. But getting funding to gather those data more formally with larger samples is just not a top priority of the government right now.
Yeah, you're not going to get it from NIDA, that's for sure. They don't want to learn anything good about marijuana. All right, one last thing that I've got. I'm coming up on a rant here. I'm going to talk a little bit about child endangerment when they take kids away because the parents are growing pot. Right. And as I was doing some research on this and looking through some of the stories, I found a commenter on one of the pages talking about a study that had been done. And I don't have it in front of me, and I just vaguely recall the numbers, but it was a study of infants who had been born drug positive, whether they were positive for cocaine or meth or alcohol or cannabis, whatever it was. They tracked these babies for 2 years, and they wanted to find out what the rate of infant death was among these kids. And out of 500, something like 44 of them had died in that 2 year span. And the numbers they found were with, cocaine and meth and alcohol, like in the double digits, like 17 per 1,000 births or 16 or 15, somewhere in that range. And for cannabis, not only was it like something like 8 or 9 deaths per 1,000 live births, but it was also lower than the babies who had been born drug negative. I'm wondering if you recall this study and was it on the right track? Was this commenter right on this?
I've seen something loosely associated with that, but it always focuses on exposure in utero, mm-hmm. and it may not particularly generalize to the situations where you've got growers at the house and kids at the house. Nevertheless, we don't see, from Mary Lane Mothry's data, big negative consequences of early exposure to cannabis for little kids, particularly if it's a one-time incident or something like that. Obviously, I'm not saying little kids should smoke pot every day, but this is not anywhere near as toxic as all the other drugs you mentioned, including alcohol, and even in utero, probably not as negative a consequence as high-dose caffeine consumption, which is something we want to keep in mind. Yeah. Also, I want to emphasize that a whole lot of people are allowed to have things in their house while they have kids in their house, including my Uncle Bob, who was a devoted gunsmith and had literally dozens of guns around the house all the time when we would run around there, and we all were properly trained to not go anywhere near that stuff. I think comparable training to folks about cannabis plants would be easy enough to do, and kids are smarter and more resilient than we ever give them credit for.
Yeah, absolutely agreed on that. I think the story had to do with the Daisy Bram case, where she was initially charged with child endangerment because they had pot plants, and then they dropped those charges, but then reinstated them once they had hair tested the kids and found some cannabis residue, and they were charging her for child endangerment because she was breastfeeding while using pot. And the theory here is she's smoking pot, it's going through the breast milk, it's getting into the kids. What of that?
So at least from the primate data, from basically information from apes, less than 2% of the THC consumed by the mother would end up in the breast milk. If you want to pump and dump after smoking a joint one day and don't use that immediate breast milk afterwards, I can certainly understand. But we're literally talking about such a small amount of THC, it wouldn't get a fly high.
Mm. All right. Well, seems like just another way to discriminate against those of us who are marijuana users. Dr. Mitch, we always appreciate you coming here on Wednesdays. We'll do it again next week, folks. If you didn't get a chance to get your question in, check 420radio.org/contact if you'd like to send your question in anonymously. Thank you, Dr. Mitch, and we will see you again.
Have a great night.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about kids, parents, and marijuana. Stay Stick around.
We'll be right back after these messages from our 420 friendly sponsors. Support these advertisers because their ad money goes straight to the Russ Belville Show. You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
You want answers?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
You want answers?
You have offended my family?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
And you have offended a Shaolin temple.
You can't handle the truth!
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Radical rant.
I've been following the story of Joshua Hacken. Louisiana police found him and his wife, Sharon, in a hotel room last June with their two little boys, some pot, a pipe, and some weapons after being notified of a disturbance. Police claim the couple was under the influence of narcotics, or actually marijuana, and Joshua was charged with possession of marijuana, possession of drug paraphernalia, and use of a controlled and dangerous substance in the presence of minors. That would be the marijuana, not the weapons, which apparently were all legally possessed as there were no weapons charges added. While Joshua, their father, spent a week or so in a Louisiana jail, their mother, Sharon, was not charged with any crimes and was not in jail. But the state of Louisiana didn't leave the children with their free mother. The state took the one-year-old and three-year-old from the Hacken family and placed them into foster care. Because, you see, when the police arrived, the Hackens were a little under the influence and babbling about taking a final journey to Armageddon. And since there were narcotics and completely legal weapons in the room, well, they must be crazy suiciders and an imminent danger to their kids. What happens next are clearly the actions of a desperate man. Upon release from jail, Joshua takes a gun and finds the foster home where his little boys are kept. He's unable to get into the home, and he flees as the foster parents call 911. From that action, a Louisiana judge grants permanent custody of his two children to their grandmother. Fast forward to months later, this week, when Joshua ties up Grandma with zip ties and abducts his own kids from her home in Florida. Immediately, the Florida sheriffs are characterizing Joshua as having been arrested in Louisiana at an anti-government rally. The Amber Alert for the Kids prominently describes the anti-government dad as armed and dangerous. You know, when I first read anti-government rally, I asked myself, which one? Occupy, Tea Party, or the Republican National Convention? Well, today, we learned that Joshua and Sharon and their two boys and their family dog boarded their sailboat and made it to Cuba. The authorities in Cuba, despite lacking an extradition treaty with the United States, agree to send the Hackens back to the United States, where their children can be placed back with Grandma and their parents can miss their kids' entire childhood, serving time for kidnapping, burglary with battery, and a host of other charges. We also hear from the Louisiana police that they have no idea what this anti-government rally is. Nobody can seem to figure out how that became part of the narrative. Mike Riggs at Reason.com dug into Joshua's online postings and found him to be somewhat libertarian, a little bit Tea Party, maybe a dash of atheist, but nothing like the rantings of, say, the Unabomber or Bind, Torture, Kill or Hell, even Julian Assange. Look, I'm not here to defend Joshua's actions. Many people lose their kids to Child Protective Services for the flimsiest of reasons, but most of them just grit their teeth, suck it up, and wade through the execrable morass that is civil family law here in America. That foster family didn't deserve to have a gun-toting angry dad scaring the hell out of them. Grandma surely didn't deserve to be zip-tied in her own home. And those two little boys didn't deserve the dangerous 90-mile sailboat trip in a rough ocean that put them at risk. But I still can't help but go back to that June night in a hotel room in Slidell, Louisiana, and ask, if it had been a case of beer instead of pot and a pipe, wouldn't the Hacken family still be together? Because if it was beer, what do you charge the dad with? Overzealous apocalyptic babbling while drunk? Hell, we'd have to take half of Portland in for that. Third degree creeping us out? I mean, what's the charge? There's no sign that they weren't loving and capable parents. There's no sign that they possessed their weapons illegally or carelessly. Even if the cops did find a need to take a drunk and creepy Joshua in for the night, wouldn't they have left the kids with Sharon? Ah, but because marijuana is a narcotic, it's a crime to have this dangerous substance in the presence of minors. We must protect the children by traumatically separating them from their mom and dad and placing them with a stranger. Not the weapons, though. It's no crime to have that dangerous substance in the presence of minors. That leads me to some news stories from just the past 30 days. Here's one from The Guardian. A 4-year-old boy in New Jersey has shot dead a playmate, age 6, with a .22 caliber rifle in what police have said was an accident. It was too early in the investigation to know whether anyone would be charged. Here's from the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. A 4-year-old boy grabbed a loaded gun at a family cookout and accidentally shot and killed the wife of a sheriff's deputy, authorities said on Monday. The sheriff would wait for the Bureau of Investigations to complete its investigation before making a decision about what to do with the deputy, but did not anticipate that the shooting would affect his job. Here's from South Carolina, Myrtle Beach Online. Police say a 3-year-old child has died after finding a gun in an apartment in Sumter. Police say they are investigating the shooting and have not released any other details. No charges have been filed. Here's one from Alabama.com. The gun grabbed by a Mobile 4-year-old who accidentally and fatally shot himself on Easter Sunday was in plain sight and had no safety mechanism, according to the Mobile County District Attorney Ashley Rich. The District Attorney's Office is working with federal law enforcement officials, including the U.S. Attorney's Office, to determine whether any charges will be filed. Here's one from NBC News. A 10-month-old boy was shot and killed by his father Thursday in an apparent accident in a Nashville, Tennessee hotel, local media reported. Attempts to reach the police department were unsuccessful Friday. WSMV said a police investigation was continuing. Here we have 5 children, all the same ages as the Hacken boys, killed by a dangerous substance, bullets. And yet it takes weeks of investigation to determine whether anyone will be charged with a crime, if at all. But if you have a bag of weed in your hotel room and cops think you're a little goofy, well, they'll take your kids right away and throw you in jail immediately, no questions asked. Hell, you don't even need to be talking apocalyptically or even have any weapons. Marijuana alone, even legally used medical marijuana, is enough for the state to declare you a menace to the children. Here's another set of stories from just the past 30 days. Lake County News. A Redwood Valley man was arrested Sunday in Lakeport for possession of more than 3 pounds of processed marijuana and child endangerment. From the Freehold Patch. A resident accused of marijuana possession and child endangerment. A Freehold man faces 3 drug-related charges after he allegedly possessed marijuana in a home where he had a legal duty to care for a child. From the Buffalo News, Buffalo, New York. Paul F. Seagrave Jr., age 28, of Kenmore, was on a break from work and went to the Niagara Falls Boulevard motel room to smoke marijuana with a coworker and the babysitter, deputy said. He was charged with child endangerment, possession of marijuana, and criminal possession of a controlled substance. Child Protective Services also was notified, deputy said. Here's from the Reading Record Searchlight. Sangthong Monavong, age 44, and Daniil Vorabout, age 48, were arrested on suspicion of several charges related to marijuana and child endangerment, said deputies with the Trinity County Sheriff's Office. They said they found 95 pounds of processed marijuana, a gun, 4 growing plants, and 165 seedlings. And this from the Daily Chronicle. Medical marijuana patient Daisy Bram was arrested on suspicion of cultivating marijuana, possessing it for sale, and child endangerment. The child endangerment charges stemmed from marijuana being found in the home with children present, as well as Daisy's consumption of cannabis while breastfeeding. Her children have been seized once again, as has her 12-year-old personal vehicle, which authorities claimed was purchased with the fruits of crime. You can keep a loaded gun within the reach of your kids, and if they shoot someone dead with it, it's just an accident. But if you keep some marijuana within the reach of your kids and they what would they do? Accidentally eat it? Roll it up and smoke it? Steal some and sell it to other school kids? No matter what happens with the pot, nobody is going to die. Yet you will be charged with child endangerment, lose your kids, and go straight to jail. If there is any endangerment to the kids, I mean, if you really want to stretch the definition by supposing that since, well, pot's illegal, and if you have a lot of pot, you could be a target for a violent theft. But then being rich, period, would be child endangerment by that definition. I suppose it's endangerment in the sense that a kid who ate some might have a bad trip, but by that definition, every parent in America better have a locked liquor cabinet, a locked medicine cabinet, and keep a real close eye on the cigarettes. Now, folks, this is just another way marijuana smokers are second-class citizens in America. You can drink all the beer you like, and we'd have to prove you're a bad parent before we take your kids. But smoke any pot at all, and you're a bad parent by definition. You can have all the guns you like, and your kid has to shoot someone before anybody asks about your home gun safety procedures. But smoke any pot at all, and it's assumed you're recklessly setting the stage for your child's future drug addiction. And I am not trying to demonize guns in any way. I am trying to say if we live in a society where we can accept that we have a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and we're not going to do anything about requiring registration or safety locks or anything like that. We can accept that, and we can see day after day children being shot and killed by these guns, and we accept that as just the cost of the Second Amendment, then by God, we can accept that some Americans smoke pot. Can't we? Are we really in a country where we are going to fight for the right to have assault weapons and 30-round clips, but people who might smoke a joint are a danger to their kids? This is insane. If we really cared about the children, we'd legalize marijuana. We'd take it out of criminal markets. We'd make sure that they were carded. And if parents were irresponsible, and if parents were letting their kids get into the weed, we can still punish them for that. But to take away their kids, to put them through a traumatic separation, to put them in a foster care system, to force these parents to have to go to the expense of hiring lawyers and getting off work and going through the court system just to see their kids, it's a surprise we haven't had more Joshua Hackens fighting against this system with firearms and running, of all places, to Cuba so they can be free as a family. It's all the time we got here, and I gotta smoke something. Lost my blood pressure, you know. That's all the time we got. Thanks for joining us here. We're gonna stick around. Hour 2, Toker Talk Radio. We'll take your calls here at 971-533-7111. Talk about more stories and hopefully lighten our mood a little bit. For Brian the Rat, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. Take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it.
you do.